Today on Against the Grain, most of us have a growing sense that something's deeply wrong with the way that digital data is used to track and monitor us. But most of us don't realize that the poorest amongst us are particularly vulnerable. I'm Sasha Lilly. My guest, Virginia Eubanks, argues that such data is used to criminalize and turn the poor away from public resources to which they are entitled. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's impossible to exist in this society without data being gathered about you in one way or another, and risk models being used to determine whether you're eligible for a bank loan or health insurance or other such crucial services. Many of these we associate with the commercial sector, but they're also being widely deployed by public agencies that determine whether someone is eligible for the likes of welfare, food stamps, or public housing. And if you're a poor person, Virginia Eubanks argues, you may find yourself in what she calls the digital poorhouse, with very little chance of ever getting out. Eubanks is Associate Professor of Political Science at SUNY Albany and digs into how digital data discourages the needy from getting public services in her book, Automating Inequality: How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor, which is published by St. Martin's Press. Virginia, you write that in the past 40 years, there's been a momentous shift in the way that key decisions are made about our lives instead of people. Equations, algorithms, and various models mark the limits of our life chances, especially if we're poor. Tell us what you mean by this change toward the use of digital data in these crucial decisions.
I think that the kind of shift to digital data and to sort of data analytics that we're seeing having more and more decision-making control over our lives is happening to a lot of us, right? So it can be anything from the kinds of search results you see in Google to who gets access to public services like food stamps or EITC or TANF. So I'm particularly interested in where these systems are being implemented in communities that I think of as low rights communities. So places where it is often the case that people's most basic human rights are not being respected, because I feel like those communities are the places where some of the most intrusive and invasive and some of the most sophisticated of these systems show up. So I've looked specifically at an attempt to automate all of the eligibility processes for the state of Indiana's welfare system, at a database and an algorithm system that ranks unhoused people in Los Angeles County to decide who gets priority for services, and in Allegheny County, which is where Pittsburgh is, a predictive model that is supposed to be able to predict which children might be victims of abuse or neglect in the future. And so when I talk about this sort of shift to digital decision making, I'm talking about a move away from processes where human beings had some level of discretion over who gets access to their basic human rights, things like food, shelter, and family. I will say that before the last, say, 30 years, certainly there were processes, bureaucratic processes, that made human beings kind of act like computers already. But I do think that there are some important things that are different all around how these digital decision-making systems work. And largely, they've been pretty invisibly integrated into our public service systems in the United States. And one of the things that I really hope my book does is bring them up to visibility so we can have some like really difficult conversations around them, because I really do believe that many of these systems, even though they get, they often are talked about as simple administrative upgrades, actually embody really consequential political decisions, and they often are implemented and instantiated without us really talking about them. And so I hope that the book is an opportunity for us to have those tough conversations.
And I'll certainly be asking you about how the poor in particular in marginalized communities can end up suffering most from these systems. But can you just give us an example of what you mean? Like, some of us have a sort of rough sense of how algorithms might be deployed to figure out certain systems and how our information is used. How will we put it all together?
Sure. So I can just give an example from my own experience, sure. Which is the example that sort of starts the book. So right as I sat down to start writing the manuscript of Automating Inequality, my much beloved partner of 13 years, Jason Martin, was attacked and robbed in about a block away from our house and beaten really very, very badly. And it required lots of reconstructive surgery and lots of healing. And one of the things that was roughest about that experience for us is that right after he had his major surgery, I went to pick up his painkillers at the drugstore, and the pharmacist told me they had canceled the prescription because we no longer had health insurance. And I was shocked to hear that we did not have health insurance because we had just a couple of days before. So I sort of rushed home and I called my insurer, and they informed me that I didn't have a start date for my coverage. And I said, well, that's weird because we had a start date a week ago. Like, you paid a claim that we made in the emergency room. So why am I not showing a start date now? And they said, oh, it must have just been a mistake. Like, somebody in the call center must have accidentally erased a digit. And we'll see what's going on. We'll be sure to fix it. And I said, well, so you've rejected these claims that we made for the surgery, though. Well, you know, will those be cleared up? And they said, well, no, because you didn't have health insurance at the time, right? Those claims won't be paid. So I was, in a panic, but also am a person who spent the last 20 years studying the way that algorithms make decisions about our lives. And so I immediately suspected, and still do believe, that what had happened is that we had had some of the major indicators of health insurance fraud. So it was a new policy. It was just a week old before I had changed jobs, and the policy was a week old before Jason was attacked. He got most of his services late at night. We're not married. We're domestic partners. And his prescriptions included controlled substances. And so all of those things are red flags for insurance fraud. So what I believe happened is this algorithm, this sort of digital decision-making system, had said, oh, four red flags, suspend their service until we investigate them.
So the whole thing about not having a start date, do you think that was a fiction?
So I will never know. And this is one of the things that's really complicated about these systems, is you get this sense that an electronic eye has been turned on you, and yet you often can't get a clear answer. So it felt so much to me like when you, use your credit card in a weird way, and all of a sudden your credit card just stops working, which is basically they're doing a brief investigation for fraud. It felt so much to me like that I never got a clear answer from them. I asked them. They continued to tell me, oh, it's just a technical error. It's just a problem in the database. But when I finally thought to get my employer to push on them, like, suddenly the problem went away. And so it felt very much to me like a kind of diversion, like an attempt to get us to stop claiming our benefits under our, and this is private health insurance, right? This isn't even Medicaid or Medicare. Yeah, so I'll never know. And that's one of the really complicated things about these systems, is that they're very hard to push back against. And also, we often experience these kinds of really negative outcomes from digital decision making when we're at our most vulnerable. So it also felt very much like we were sort of being kicked while we were down. So I think that's a good example of how these digital decision making systems work. They're often in the background. It's often really unclear if and how they've been used. And that makes them very difficult to push back against.
Broadly speaking, how does digital data and then the use of this digital data by algorithms, risk models, just generally speaking, how do we know that the poor are particularly vulnerable?
One of the reasons I wrote the book is that we're actually having a lot of really good, really insightful, really thoughtful, provocative conversations about the role of digital decision making in our lives. Again, everything from Google search, the Google search algorithm to, you know, automated driving cars. And I think that's really good and really powerful. But I am concerned that we often have these conversations in ways where they're pretty abstract and pretty future focused, right? So it tends to be like, okay, so if there's an automated driving car and it comes upon a box of puppies and a bicyclist in the street, right, which one will it hit? And we have these very abstract conversations about what we think might happen in the future. And what I am trying, one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is to sort of ground those conversations in the very real, very today, present lives of poor and working folks. And so many of the things that we talk about being possible unintended consequences in the future are actually things that people are living through right now. So my goal there is to help us have a much more concrete conversation about the way these systems work in the world we live in now, which is a world that is riven with inequality, racial injustice, deep, deep poverty. So I think looking in places like poor and working class neighborhoods, but also in communities of color, also in communities where there are undocumented migrants, also in war zones around the world, that we see some of the experimentation with technology that everyone else is going to see 5 or 10 years later. So I think that kind of mission creep is really, really common. So there's that old saw by William Gibson that says, you know, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And I believe that, but I think I mean it in the opposite way to William Gibson. So Gibson, I think, meant it that, you know, that the future's already here, but it's the rich people have access to all the fancy toys. What I mean is the future of surveillance or the future of invasive government technology is already here, but it's primarily happening in poor and working class communities or other communities that are exploited and marginalized, because that's the place where folks can get away with it. And so that's why my commitment is to starting with the people who are targets of these systems.
And that is Virginia Eubanks talking about her book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile Police and Punish the Poor, that's published by St. Martin's Press. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So then, to that end of really understanding how these technologies are especially focused on the poor, that the poor really on the cutting edge and not in a positive way of these new technologies, I wonder if you could talk about the ways that the state uses these technologies toward the poor, starting with the example of welfare and of public benefits. What did you find there in terms of how the poor can suffer some pretty serious consequences from these models being used as a port of entry to services?
Yeah, so one of the stories I tell in the book is the story of this attempt in the state of Indiana to automate and privatize all of the eligibility processes for their welfare programs. So that's Medicaid, what at the time was called food stamps is now called SNAP, and cash assistance or TANF. And this happened in 2006 when the then governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels, announced that he was going to sign a $1.13, eventually $1.4 billion contract with a coalition of high tech companies, including IBM and ACS. And part of his argument for why they should automate and privatize eligibility for welfare was that he very much saw relationships between public workers, particularly frontline caseworkers, and recipients or applicants for public services as an invitation to collusion and fraud. So when he was sort of going across the state talking up this plan to automate eligibility, he often cited this one case where a number of from a church in Indianapolis had worked together with two caseworkers to set up dummy accounts and claim food stamps based on these sort of invented people. So he crossed the state saying, like, look, when caseworkers and recipients have relationships with each other. They just find ways to defraud the state. And so the system that they built was actually quite intentionally designed to sever the relationship between caseworkers and the people that they served. And what that looked like from the point of view of recipients or applicants is that rather than talking to their local caseworker near their home, they had to apply online. And this is at a time when only 50% of low-income households in Indiana had access to internet in their home. So that's important. So they had to apply online. And then if they had any kind of issue with their application, they had to call sort of a centralized, regional, privatized call center. And so every time they called, they had to talk to a new person. There was nobody who followed their case from beginning to end. And there was nobody who was really accountable for decisions on the state side. And from the caseworker's point of view, rather than being responsible for a caseload of families or this group of families whose cases they saw from the beginning to the successful conclusion, they just responded to a list of tasks that dropped into a queue in their computerized sort of what is workflow management system. And so they were no longer responsible or responsive to individual families, but to tasks. And the result of this was a million benefits denials in the first 3 years of this experiment. And almost all of the folks who were denied for this sort of catch-all reason called failure to cooperate in establishing eligibility. And that could mean anything from, you know, failing to sign one page of a 34-page application to the call center worker making a mistake, not knowing the policy well enough to tell people what the right thing was to do in a consultation, a telephone consultation, or even the document center where they scan the documents, making an error, dropping a document behind the desk, or like receiving a fax of a photocopy of a scan of a driver's license and not being able to read it. So all applicants got was this notice that said you failed to cooperate in establishing eligibility, so we're denying you unless you can fix it in 10 to 13 days, but didn't say anything about what the mistake was. So it threw all the responsibility for finding errors and correcting them onto recipients themselves, who are some of the most vulnerable people in Indiana. And this resulted in just really horrible outcomes for poor and working families. So Omega Young of Evansville was denied her Medicaid because she missed a phone appointment because she was in the hospital suffering from terminal cancer. Sophie Stipes, who is a profoundly disabled 6-year-old girl, was denied by a letter addressed directly to her, denied her Medicaid because she had failed to cooperate in establishing eligibility. Her family had to figure out what had gone wrong in 3 days to respond to this to keep her from getting thrown off Medicaid. So it really had extraordinarily damaging impacts on the poor and working families of Indiana.
Do you think that fraud was really the driving concern behind establishing this even more bureaucratic, impersonal, difficult to navigate system, since the net result was that people who were eligible ended up without benefits, and given that there is certainly a politics dating back to the 80s or 70s even about poor people are undeserving, people should not be on welfare. So do you think that there was a political dimension to the decision to implement these sort of systems, or was fraud the story and that was it?
Well, I think really that one of the things to pay attention to in this story is the way that fraud, claims of fraud, act as a cover to divert people from benefits that they are entitled to and deserve and that can save their lives. And I think we see that even more so under the current administration. And I think it's also important to say that Governor Mitch Daniels was a mentor to our current vice president, and that bears watching as well. So I don't know what was in Mitch Daniels' heart, right? I can't peer into his soul. But I can say one of the folks I interviewed for this chapter was this really brilliant Medicaid attorney in Bloomington named Chris Hawley. And Chris said, right, at least philosophically, in our criminal justice system, we've decided as a nation that it's better for 10 guilty people to go free than one guilty person to remain in jail. And again, I want to say that's philosophical and abstract, not the reality. But, he said, what this system seemed to do is turn that on its head, that it was better that 10 eligible people go without the things they need to survive than one ineligible person receive them. So he said, and I think he's right, that if they had intentionally designed a system to divert people from public assistance, it certainly wouldn't have worked better than the one they got. So I'm not sure intention is even the best question, because I don't think the results, whether or not the results were intentional, is not as important to me as whether or not they were predictable. And they were absolutely predictable. If you leave navigating an incredibly complex bureaucracy that is often set up to make sure that you fail on the heads of the most vulnerable people in the state, folks who struggle from mental health issues, folks who have physical disabilities, folks who are caring for families, right, and struggling to survive, it should not then surprise you that people lose access to the benefits that they have every right to under our current law.
You also explored the use of a system in Los Angeles that was ostensibly about pairing the homeless with housing. Tell us about how it functioned and the outcome.
Sure. So the system that I studied in Los Angeles, or that I reported on in Los Angeles, is called the Coordinated Entry System. It's not just in Los Angeles. It has largely become the de facto standard in homeless services across the country. But Los Angeles is a particularly interesting place to look at it because of really the intense and really very horrifying nature of the housing crisis in Los Angeles. So as of the last point in time homeless count, there are 58,000 unhoused people in Los Angeles County alone. So I'm from a small city in upstate New York of 50,000 people. So my entire city is homeless in Los Angeles. And something like 75% of those folks are completely unsheltered. So, you know, living out in the open, in the streets, in cars, and in tents. It is understandable that people are trying to be innovative and thoughtful about how they distribute the limited resources they have to tackle the homeless crisis or the housing crisis in Los Angeles. So the intention of the system, how it works, is that unhoused folks take this very, very intensive survey with a pretty terrible acronym. It's called the VISPDAT, the Vulnerability Index and Service Prioritization Decision Assistance Tool. So they take the VISPDAT, and their information, their data is entered into a database, and then an algorithm is run on the database to try to evaluate how vulnerable those folks are to some of the worst outcomes of being homeless, so death or mental health crisis or physical health crisis. And then a second algorithm is run to match the unhoused people by virtue of their vulnerability rank in the list to the available appropriate housing resources. And honestly, I think the intention behind the system is really good. All of the folks I spoke to on the administrative side and on the data design side seem to have really good intentions, to be really smart people and to care deeply for the folks that their agencies serve. But from the point of view, particularly of people who have taken the VISPDAT, the survey, several times and have not gotten resources because there's so few resources in Los Angeles County, that they have begun to view the system with an increasing suspicion. And there's good reason that they do. For example, unhoused people are asked to sign a very comprehensive informed consent that allows the agents, a number of agencies who have access to this data, to share it really widely. And there's a second step if the unhoused person wants to know where their data is going, there's a second step that you have to go through to request a list of all the agencies that have your data, which requires you to be physically in a spot to get this like physical list, which can be really complicated for unhoused folks. I did request that list, and it says that 168 different agencies share folks folks' information, and that information stays in the system for 7 years, and that even if you ask that your record be expunged, some of it stays in the system. And one of the main concerns that unhoused folks I spoke to had was that under current federal data standards, information that is held in this database actually is available to law enforcement with no warrant process at all, just based on an oral request. So it means a line officer can walk into a social service office, ask for information about a specific unhoused person, and while they're not required to give it to them, they're allowed to give it to them. And that's really an issue for folks because the survey asks questions like, are you currently trading sex for drugs? Or is there someone out there who thinks you owe them money? Or do you have an outstanding warrant? Or have you thought about harming yourself or someone else recently? And then it asks where you can be found at different times of the day. And it asks if they can take a picture. So for folks who have taken that survey many times, folks like one of the people I speak to is a wonderful older gentleman who goes by the nickname Uncle Gary, Gary Boatwright, who have taken this survey 3 or 4 or 5 times and still have been on and off homeless in the street for a decade or more. They often feel like they're being asked to incriminate themselves in exchange for a slightly better lottery number for housing. And that's something they're deeply concerned about.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about not just data collection, but the use of data to provide public services and the ways that these tools can be used to punish and criminalize the poor. I'm speaking with the author of Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. It's published by St. Martin's Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Its author, Virginia Eubanks, is a longtime welfare rights activist and associate professor of political science at SUNY Albany. So another case which you examined in terms of understanding how digital data is utilized by, in this case, the state to dispense services or limit people is around, in this case, around child welfare. And you looked at the risk models that were set up in Allegheny County, which is in Pennsylvania. Tell us about the models there, why they were being used, and what they led to.
Yeah, so this is the most recent case that I talk about in Automating Inequality is the system that's called the Allegheny Family Screening Tool. And that just went live in August of 2016, I believe. And it basically is a statistical model that uses data that is stored in a county data warehouse to try and predict which children might be victims of abuse or neglect sometime in the future as part of the county's decision-making around who should be investigated by what they call their children, youth, and family services, what are called in other places child protective services or child welfare. So this is a super interesting case. There's been actually quite a lot of writing about it. And I think it's a really, really important one to think about and to talk about. One of the things that families, particularly parents, were concerned about the system is that this data warehouse that the model pulls all of its information from was built in 1999, and the county, it currently holds about 1 billion records. But the database doesn't actually collect information on everyone in the county. It really only collects information on people who use county or state public services. So professional middle-class families are likely getting similar amounts of support for their parenting, but because they're paying for them through private means, they don't end up in this data warehouse. So that means, right, they might use babysitters or nannies or au pairs, and they pay them privately, so that doesn't go into the data warehouse. Or they get mental health support, but they pay for that with private insurance, so it doesn't end up in the data warehouse. So the families who are receiving some kind of public service and who are therefore therefore their data shows up in the warehouse are really concerned that this is going to create what are called false positives. And a false positive just means that the system will identify harm or potential harm where no harm actually exists. And so that's incredibly important to parents. They feel like the system, because it relies on this data that is only collected about poor and working class families, that the system confuses parenting while poor with poor parenting and creates a system of surveillance that can become sort of a feedback loop where poor families are surveilled more often, which means there's more harm found in their communities, which means they end up in these databases more often, which means they're surveilled more often. And then that becomes a feedback loop that is very hard to escape. Very similar to what we talk about when we talk about predictive policing having similar impacts. But one of the things that also came up that I didn't think about originally came up because I spent a day sitting in the call center with intake call center workers who are the screeners who get calls from the county's abuse and neglect hotline and also from mandated reporters around the state about folks' concern about children. And the intake workers said, oh, well, of course people are concerned about false positives. That's important. But we should also be concerned about false negatives. And then they explained what they mean, which is not seeing harm where harm might actually be occurring. So they pointed out to me that because this this model only has data on poor and working families, that it may not be able to see the kind of harm that does happen in professional middle class families. So, for example, there's good data that geographic isolation is correlated with child maltreatment. But that won't show up in the model because the folks who are accessing public services in Allegheny County mostly live in sort of dense urban neighborhoods or the impoverished suburbs that that ring the city. So the intake workers are also really concerned about the system missing harm where it might be occurring. So from both sides, there's a lot of concern that the limitations of the model, including what kind of data it actually has access to, will create systems that amplify harm to poor and working class families.
So what are the consequences then if someone is flagged?
So what, how the system is currently used is that when a call comes into the call center or a report from a mandated reporter comes into the call center, that this tool is part of a sort of three-step process in deciding which families will be referred for a full investigation to investigative caseworkers at Children, Youth, and Families. So that's opening a child protective investigation on families. So one of the things that I think is really important to understand about these systems is that Children, Youth, and Families does some incredibly difficult and incredibly important work that harm absolutely, that caretakers absolutely sometimes harm their children. Though some of the folks I work with might disagree with me, I actually believe that the state has an ability and a right to step in some of those cases. But often when we talk about these systems, and particularly when we talk about these high-tech tools that are increasingly used in child welfare, we only talk about the potential harm to children and not the other kinds of harms to families that happen when you open an investigation on a parent for possible maltreatment. That kind of scrutiny can really create incredible stress on a family that can actually lead to the outcomes you're trying to avoid, can lead to maltreatment. If a family is found in what's called indicated, which actually doesn't mean guilty, it just means there's enough information to suspect that something has happened. If a family is found indicated for maltreatment, that parent is put into a registry, a child abuse registry, and then cannot work in basically any profession or any volunteer opportunity that involves children until the reported child turns 25, or it's in some states 10 years after the reported child turns 25. So you have to completely change how you support yourself, right? And often in poor and working class families, the adults who are working in childcare, are working in elder care, are working in areas where that's really going to make a huge impact on their life. So how these investigations are, who gets investigated, how that's decided is incredibly important. So one of the designers I spoke to, Aaron Dalton, actually was very clear when I said, do you see how parents who are targeted by the system might feel like they're being over-scrutinized? She said, oh, absolutely. She said, all the data we have is biased against the poor. But we still think it can be useful for keeping families safe.
Wow.
And so I was really struck and asked, you know, well, do you, if you had access to, say, private insurance information, would you want to use it? And she said, oh, absolutely. If we could get access to private insurance information, I would absolutely want to use it. And then she said, but I know that'll never happen. And I think that's really the sort of key question here is, like, why is it acceptable to do this to poor and working class families when it's not acceptable to do it to professional middle class families who are asking for the same amount of support but are paying for it privately? And so that really, to me, gets at some of the key issues around why systems that amplify and speed up the existing harms in our current system should be of great, great concern to us.
I'm speaking with Virginia Eubanks, is Associate Professor of Political Science at SUNY Albany. I wanted to ask you about the history of the poor being targeted for surveillance and for tracking and for compliance in various different ways, because what you are arguing is that while something has shifted in the way that information is collected, in the way information is deployed over the last 30 years intensifying as we get closer to the present, that this is actually not something new and can't just be therefore laid at the feet of technology.
Yeah. So what I think is the most important sort of contributions that the book makes is this metaphor of the digital poorhouse. And I use that metaphor really, really consciously. Because if you look at our history, going well back into the early 1800s, we have developed in this country a way of thinking about poverty management that has more to do with moral diagnosis, with deciding who is most deserving for support, than systems that say put a universal floor under everyone. And that decision goes back to the 1820s, where after a huge, many of the conditions should sound familiar, after a huge economic catastrophe, the Depression of 1819, economic elites got really concerned about what they called pauperism, which was dependence on public benefits. And so they decided to create a new technology that would keep those folks who they believed were not deserving of help from asking for their share of our shared public resources. And that was the brick and mortar county poorhouse. So these were institutions that were intended to incarcerate the poor, the original intention was to build one in every county in the United States. So if you live in a place that has a poor farm road or a poor house road or a county farm road or a state farm road, that's where your poorhouse was. Basically, the conditions of entry into the poorhouse were so horrifying that it acted as a diversion mechanism that kept people from asking for public benefits or for their fair share of our shared resources. So the conditions included things like if you at the time had the right to vote or marry or hold office, and that certainly wasn't everyone because we're talking the 1820s. So this is mostly just white men. But if you had those rights, you had to sign a pauper's oath that meant you gave them up upon entering the poorhouse. Families were separated because it was believed that poor children could be redeemed by having more contact with middle class and wealthy families. What that contact usually was working for them as domestics or agricultural laborers. So your family was separated when you entered the poorhouse. And finally, the the conditions were just really appalling, right? So the death rates at some of these institutions were 30% annually, which meant a third of people who entered the poorhouse every year died. So there's the remains of a poorhouse in my hometown, and there's a burying ground that is completely unmarked that has, you know, the remains of thousands of poor and working people still there. And that's true in thousands of communities across the United States. So these were really pretty horrifying institutions that were meant as a diversionary tactic. They were meant to frighten people so badly that they wouldn't ask for support unless they were absolutely at their very last sort of breath. And so they were these institutions that were more about moral diagnosis, were more about deciding whether or not you were poor enough and suffering enough to deserve help than they were about redistributing resources in a way that unleashes everybody's human capacity. And I believe that that set the sort of deep social programming of the tools that we're seeing today. So, of course, the sort of technological capacity we have right now could easily be used to decide who and how to distribute universal basic income, right? But that's not the system we're getting, because the system is built on this deep social programming that I really believe is grounded in the county poorhouse, and then later mechanisms of scientific charity and other kinds of systems that see the role of public assistance as being mostly about investigation rather than providing equal support.
Well, given that history, then in terms of thinking about how to resist the push of the encroachment of these technologies into all of our lives, but bearing in mind what you're saying, which is there's a particular history and we have a social system that grows out of that earlier social system. So how do we oppose this then? Should we be opposing it? Should we be struggling around the criminalization of the poor generally? Is there a place to be fighting these technologies as they might apply to people who are more affluent? How do you think we should go at it?
Yeah. So first, I want to say that even though that metaphor of the digital poorhouse, I think, is really powerful and really apt, there are some ways it falls short, because what we're seeing now is different from the old poorhouse in some important ways. And those are important to understanding the solutions. So first, these new tools scale much faster than something like a brick and mortar institution for incarcerating the poor, right? We were supposed to have a poorhouse in every county in the United States, and we ended up with something like 1,000. But like, they couldn't scale up fast enough, and they were incredibly expensive. And so that, as a mechanism for regulating poor people's behavior, that didn't scale. These new tools scale much more quickly. The barriers to scaling are much lower.
So they could be applied all over the place very easily.
Very, very quickly. And so you see right in Los Angeles that coordinated entry was a pilot program in one neighborhood in 2013. By the time the book came out in 2018, it sort of coordinated entry was standard practice everywhere. So there's this incredibly fast scaling. Another difference is that the actual record of data that is produced by the digital poorhouse is potentially eternal, right? The records of the actual physical poorhouse, like the ledgers, the leather-bound ledgers, eventually most of them sort of moldered to dust. They rarely dealt with a person in more than a couple of phrases. And the record that we're producing with the digital poorhouse is much more intense, much more invasive, much more comprehensive, and it lasts potentially forever. And so I'm going to say, those of us who are old and are sitting on a bunch of jazz discs, like in a box in their desk, know that how eternal digital records actually are is actually complicated. But there is the potential for these records to follow people forever, sort of like a shadow on their life. And another thing that's possible with the digital poorhouse that wasn't possible with past mechanisms of poverty regulation is that the digital poorhouse doesn't just investigate and track individuals, they track networks of people. So, for example, in Allegheny County, the risk model is not run just on the parent or the child who are reported to the hotline. It's run on everyone who is associated with the household. So that might be a parent, and the child who's reported, but it's also run on every other child in the house. And the parents' ex-paramours, so people they dated, you know, 3 years ago, or like the cousin who lived upstairs, you know, for 3 months last year. So these tools really have the possibility of running through communities like viruses. And the harms are, I think, potentially exponential. And then the last thing that's different is one of the sort of unique and I think unexpected things about actual physical poorhouses is they actually became sites of great resistance, right? If you put hundreds of poor and working people in big common rooms, even in horrible conditions, right, there's going to be bad stuff that happens, but there's also going to be times where people start to see their experience mirrored in each other and care for each other and develop relationships. And so poorhouses actually became sites of resistance in some ways that are really important. So one of the things that I think is quite different about the digital poorhouse is this kind of digital sort of invisible scrutiny can be incredibly isolating. And that was my own experience with being red flagged for insurance fraud, is just I was so exhausted by being sort of kicked while we were down that it was very hard for me to reach out for help to anyone else. And so there's a way that I fear these tools can increasingly isolate people, make them not want to engage in their networks in ways that protect their survival and help them thrive, because your networks are now sort of criminalized. So I'm really concerned about that. And I think that's one of the main places for resistance, right? So I often, when people ask me for solutions, like, I totally understand that what people want is for me to give them like a 5-point plan in building better technologies. And I'd love to be able to do that. But it's not going to work in the world we currently live in. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to happen before we get fairer technologies. One is cultural work. So we tell this story in the United States that poverty happens, is an aberration, that it happens mostly to a small minority of probably pathological people. And that's simply not true. So Mark Rank's fabulous life cycle research shows that 51% of us will be below the poverty line at some point in our adult lives between 20 and 64, and that a full 2/3 of us will receive means-tested public assistance. So that's not like reduced cost school lunches or Social Security, that's straight welfare. So poverty is a majority experience in the United States, and the way we talk about it makes it seem as if it's not. That's not to say that we all experience it in the same way. We absolutely don't. If you are a person of color, if you are born poor, if you have physical disabilities or mental health crises or issues, if you're caring for other people, you're much more likely to become poor, and it's going to be much harder to escape poverty once you're there. So that's not to say that we all experience it equally, or that we're all equally vulnerable. But poverty is a majority experience. So we need to tell the truth. I think we don't tell the truth about our own experiences, and I think we ignore the truth of other people's experiences. So that needs to happen really first. Hopefully that can drive political work around creating mechanisms for sharing our social wealth in ways that are more fair and are less punitive. And that can look like anything from a universal basic income. And I think the devil's in the details in UBIs. I would not sign off on any UBI, but I think it's something to think about. But that can be anything from UBIs to creating community-based alternatives to going to the state for your basic human needs, to creating county, local, state, and federal public assistance systems that are more fair and more just. So that political work really has to happen. And in the meantime, we need to create technologies that do less harm. So in Automating Inequality, I suggest sort of a draft of a Hippocratic Oath for data scientists. But it really boils down for me to sort of two basic questions. The first is, does the system that you're developing, does it increase the self-determination and dignity of poor and working people? And the second is, if it was aimed at anyone but poor and working people, would it be tolerated? And unfortunately, all three of the systems I look at the book don't even reach this very feeble standard for democracy, equity, and justice.
Do you feel like there's an opening around seeing digital data information technologies in particular, critically, because after quite a long honeymoon, the idea that, you know, a utopian future was opening before us with all this information, and now people are seeing the darker side of it all and having a sense of unease. Now, obviously, when one's talking about these things, it's a very wide spectrum, right, from kind of public institutions to the corporations that we most hear about, like Facebook, those private companies that are collecting our data. But there does seem to be a kind of disquiet that's developing around this. And I wonder if you think that this provides some opportunity for activists to kind of go at the heart of the problem, not simply around restructuring how information is collected, but just around the notion of collecting data.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're seeing some really exciting connections being made across social movements, right? Everything from Data for Black Lives to a project that I've been involved in called the Our Data Bodies Project, right? That people are talking, I talked earlier about the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition that has done a lot of this great work. So there's a ton of work that's happening on the ground to create spaces for folks who are experiencing sort of the most invasive, intrusive systems to talk about their experiences and to build mechanisms or strengthen mechanisms that they already have for community and personal self-defense and survival. I think that work is happening all over the place. I think the sort of Wild West moment of data, where people could assume that they could collect everything they wanted, keep it forever and use it however they want, I'm here to tell them that moment's over if they haven't figured that out already. And I do think that we are seeing a lot of people begin to push back on this in ways that are going to be really exciting and really productive.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Virginia Eubanks about her book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. That's published by St. Martin's Press. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at SUNY Albany and a longtime welfare rights activist. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.